Thank you very much. And it is lovely to be in Seattle when it's not a police state. Of course, things have changed dramatically since then, and the police are now very friendly and nice. The idea of stuffed and starved is pretty straightforward. That we face, we live in a world of profound contradiction. We live in a world where, at the same time as we produce more food than we ever have in human history, there are 850 million people in the most recent figures, and that number will go up. About 850 million people who go hungry every year, and a billion people who are overweight. Now, it's easy to think that, the fat people are in America and the thin people are in Africa. And to some extent, that's true. I mean, only 3 out of 10 Americans now have normal body weight, and the rest of you are a little podgy. But at the same time, every year, in the most recent year we have figures for, 35.5 million Americans went hungry. So the kinds of contradictions of between obesity and hunger happen in every country in the world. I mean, the most overweight country in the world is this one, but the second most overweight country in the world is Mexico. And again, this has everything to do not with a deficit of the will or to do with, certain kinds of moral failure, as we're encouraged to think by the dieting industry, but to do with the structure of the way food gets to us and the fact that food gets to us through markets. And to show this, I'd like to use my stage prop here. Because it's interesting to think about how little we know about our food. If we just look at the, my goodness, if we look at the ingredients, it's sort of a long concatenation of mysterious things. Number one is chocolate, but even that is mysterious because we don't know where it comes from. If it comes from the Ivory Coast, as a lot of the world's chocolate does, then there is a small but significant chance that it was grown using child slavery. But the interesting ingredient for me here is one that comes a little bit further down the list, called lecithin. You may have seen that in your food before. You have wondered. Lecithin is an emulsifier. It is there to encourage the fats and the... The fats and the water. It encourages the fat and the water to stick together and not separate out so that this Snickers bar can stay on the shelves fresh for an eternity. Now, lecithin isn't there primarily for our enjoyment. It is there to increase the shelf life of this product. And it is there because of... It isn't an ingredient that we actually eat every day, pretty much. It comes from a source that is in 3/4 of all processed food in U.S. supermarkets. 3/4 of processed food in U.S. supermarkets, and almost everything sold by the fast food industry contains this secret ingredient. That ingredient is soy. Soy, to me, is a wonderful illustration about how modern industrial farming and modern industrial capitalism can turn something that's gorgeous into something that's a curse. Because soy is sexy. Soy is a fantabulous crop. It's nitrogen fixing, so it's great for the soil. And the protein that it produces in its beans has a variety that looks more like an animal than a vegetable. And, of course, soy is tremendously flexible. It can be used in everything from vegetable oil. The most widely consumed vegetable oil in the United States is soy. You can be used from that to ink. The ink in our newspapers is likely soy-based. Soy is really very flexible, and it's a great crop. It can withstand all kinds of foliage damage, still keep on trucking. It's a great crop. But it's interesting to me that one of the first soy obsessives in the United States was also the godfather of modern capitalism, Henry Ford. Henry Ford was big on soy. He wanted one day, in the 1930s, they were beginning to discover the amazing range of things that you could do with soy. And he hoped one day to grow entire cars out of soy. This may sound a little fanciful, but actually by the end of the 1930s, there were 2 bushels of soy in every car that the Ford Motor Company produced. And they were there for things like pigment or, as fiber, or they tried making a lacquer out of it, to put up on the inside of the car. But unfortunately, that didn't work out so well because it smelled like a mortuary. So they sort of backed away from that. But Ford was still very big on it. And he had this party in 1935 in his Dearborn, Michigan plant. And he sort of came down the marble staircase and he was wearing this gorgeous suit, this sort of cream-colored thing. And he commanded people to stroke his suit. And, you know, it was Henry Ford, so people did what they were told. And they stroked his suit, and it was as soft as down. They were like, well done, Henry Ford, very soft. And he said, no, but more importantly, this suit is made entirely out of soy. And they were like, oh, very good, well done. And it cost $40,000, or $500,000 in today's money. Yes, frivolous. But it's interesting that, again, it is Henry Ford who is an obsessive about soy, because it is through the modern industrial growing of soy that this wonderful and flexible and gorgeous crop has become a nightmare. Because if the soy in this bar doesn't come from the United States, then it will likely come from Brazil, the world's largest soy exporter by most measures. And if it comes from Brazil, then it may come from one of the many soy plantations that is now encroaching into the Brazilian Cerrado and into the Amazon rainforest proper. There's case upon case now of soy farms being the ones that are encroaching into the Amazon. You know, we used to hear that McDonald's were sending the cows out into the Amazon. It's soy farms. And that's, you know, that is also, so there's environmental degradation just from that. Then, of course, the water is being drained out of the soil in Brazil. One of the world's largest aquifers is in Brazil, and it sort of covers a bunch of neighboring countries too, the Guarani aquifer, and that's being drained dry. And, of course, it is on soy farms, as well as biofuel plantations, that Brazil's 40,000 agricultural slaves live today. There is slavery in our food. We'd like to think that our food is free from that taint, but in soy, and particularly in biofuels in Brazil, slavery is alive and well by, you know, the estimates of the International Labour Organization. These are only estimates, of course, because the International Labour Organization officials who go and investigate this tend not to survive very long. And there's, you know, the slave sort of slave owners in these plantations also have a fairly vicious reputation of murder and intimidation. So, that's an example of how our food is a mystery. And the egregious practices that are required in its production. So who benefits? Who wins from this? Well, we'd like to think that it's farmers, but actually we have an intuition that helps us understand who wins from cheap labor and environmental costs that never factor into the price of food. Think about the price of oil for a second. When the price of oil goes up, do we imagine that it is oil workers who are suddenly having money sort of fall out of their pockets and driving around in Bentleys? No, it's not oil workers. It's not the people who are drilling for oil. Just as much as it's not the people on the gas station forecourt who are selling us our gasoline. Well, they're not making money out of the high oil price either. We understand that when it comes to oil, there are a few corporations and a few financial speculators who make the big chunk of cash involved. And that's the way it is with food. In the book, I've got this sort of what I call an hourglass figure. If you imagine the millions of farmers around the world who grow our food, and the billions of us underneath who eat it, and between the farmers and us are just a handful of corporations who have a chokehold on the food system. In any major market, it's basically four or five food corporations that control more than half the market. In the market for tea, for example, is 90% controlled by Unilever, by the Anglo-Dutch multinational. Just one company, 90%. And it is those corporations that are basically taking us for a ride. And it's interesting because we allow this to happen because somewhere in the back of our heads is the idea that having lots of, having corporations compete against one another, well, that's going to be good for us, right? We have lots of competition, price goes down, consumers, thumbs up, everything's happy. It doesn't work that way. And the example in evidence, I would like to quote to you a man called Duane Andreas. Duane Andreas was the head of Archer Daniels Midland, a company that you may have heard from public radio. But they are, of course, also one of the world's largest grain corporations. Archer Daniels Midland, Cargill, Bunge, ConAgra, these are the giants of the international grain trade. And although they, you know, they try and ingratiate themselves by sponsoring Fresh Air, they do kind of suck the oxygen from the room when it comes to the sort of more profound discussions around corporate power. And so this is what Duane Andreas has to say about competition. His words are, "The competitor is our friend and the customer is our enemy. There is not one grain of anything in the world that is sold in a free market. Not one. The only place that you see free markets are in the speeches of politicians. People who are not from the Midwest do not realize that this is a socialist country." That's Duane Andreas on the merits of free market capitalism there. In a sense, he's right, because he takes collusion very seriously. In fact, until recently, the largest fraud case in U.S. legal history involved Archer Daniels Midland and the driving up of prices for a soy-based meat additive called lysine. And in fact, most of the soy that we eat is processed usually by animals. I mean, we can industrially process it, but most soy is processed by animals first because they can access the good stuff in soy. If you eat raw soybeans, as I did in the research for this book, you will discover that you get nothing but flatulence. So let me save you some time there. So soybeans. So the question then is, these corporations are kind of doing what corporations do. They're buying cheap and they're selling dear. They're buying cheap from the poorest people on earth, from farmers, and they're selling us heavily processed food that's making us overweight and obese. So the interesting question for me is, why markets? Where do markets come from? Well, where do international markets in food come from? Because it's very clear that corporations are happy with them, but. They're weird. They're new. The world's first international market in food is the global market in wheat. And that was only really completed and perfected by the 1880s. It's a very new phenomenon, this global market in wheat stuff. Now, for markets to happen, they were imposed through colonialism and some fairly brutal kinds of international diplomacy and economics. There's not a place that sort of shows this better for me than India. India was a feudal society before the British came, and that means that there were peasants who worked the land and then had their, basically everything that they didn't need to be able to survive was taken away by the landlord, and it was rubbish. But the silver lining was, in a bad year, it was the landlord's responsibility to feed the peasantry. So there were social systems developed to be able to smooth out the sort of good times and bad times. When the British came, the British were after grain. They wanted cheap grain to be able to feed their workers in Britain. And when they saw that the way Indians were underproducing grain, they thought it was pathetically backward. That the way to encourage Indians to up their grain productivity was to impose markets in food and to help people realize that they didn't want a hand out, they wanted a hand up. The sort of language of compassionate conservatism was sort of actually very similar. That we hear it today, but it's actually kind of similar to the way the British came and imposed free markets in food in India, and it worked very well for people who could afford food. In India, the amount of grain produced increased massively, and a large chunk of it was taken from India to Britain, where it fed the hungry industrial workers of the world. In India, of course, things weren't quite so good, because the rules of the market are this, that if you can't afford food, you don't get to eat. Them's the rules. There's nothing that expresses that the consequences of this so painfully. As the following statistic, which the historian Mike Davis has dug up, which is this. In the 2,000 years before the British came to India, in the two millennia before the British came to India, there was a famine once every 120 years, more than once a century. You'd have to wait for a famine. After the British came, there was a famine once every 4 years. Now, that transformation happened just, you know, at the moment of the imposition of markets in food, it was the golden age of liberal capitalism. And what went for India went for the rest of the planet. And through the imposition of markets in food, the number of people who died on this earth were 30 million people. 30 million people died in the most vicious and brutal microeconomics lesson in world history, learning that the only way, the proper way to get food was not to have it, but to pay for it. Now, what we're seeing today is kind of an extension of that. And although I don't want to belabor India as an example, but it is a very interesting example about what goes wrong when markets go wild. And it's also, I mean, it's interesting. When I was growing up, my parents used to tell me, eat your meal, eat your greens. There are children starving in Africa. I imagine they did that. Your parents would have told you that too. But think for a second about what do parents in Africa tell their kids? They get it more right. They say, eat your greens. There are children starving in India. And there are. There are more children starving in India than there are on the entire continent of Africa. And India is, I mean, it's an amazing place. Obviously, we sort of think of India, particularly in the United States, as a sort of never-never land where all the jobs have flown. And where everyone has a PhD in computer science, and, you know, everyone can defragment your hard drive at the street corner and tell you how to use Windows Vista. No one can tell you how to use Windows Vista. I shouldn't be saying I'm insulting the home team here, but. And if you go to Bangalore, for example, you'll see the sort of glittering temples of information technology capitalism. You'll see your Microsoft and your Infosys and your Google and your Intel and what have you. But 5 hours away from that is a very different story, because India is predominantly a rural country. And if you go to rural India, you will hear tales of desperation. And certainly the hardest part of writing Stuffed and Starved was talking to farmers and families of farmers who had despaired. I'll give you one example, but it's one that stands for farmers around the world. It's a story about a man called Kistaya. Let's call him Kistaya. He wanted, as every parent does, he wanted to leave his kids more than he had. And he farmed about half an acre. And he figured that what he would like to do is irrigate his land and increase the productivity on his land so his kids would have better quality land and this sort of thing. So he borrowed money from the local moneylender, and he drilled a hole for a bore, you know, a borehole for a well. And the well was dry. And so he was seriously in trouble, because he needed not only to increase the productivity on his land for his kids, but he needed to repay the loan from the moneylender. So he borrowed more money and drilled another hole, and it was dry. And another hole, and it was dry. And borrowed again, and it was dry. And one summer day, with the rains refusing to come, he despaired. And that evening, he, after his wife and kids have gone to bed, he pulled down a pesticide called 4-8. It's illegal here, but it is sold by U.S. corporations in the developing world. And it is he mixed it with water, and he drank it. And it would have been an agonizing death. His nerves would have jammed. He would have asphyxiated. Excuse me. And yet, he can't have convulsed very hard. Because he died without waking his wife and two kids. Now, that story is made all the worse by, you know, when you hear the figures involved, that it would have taken him 95 years to pay off his loan of 15,000 rupees, or $350. He died for $350. And that story is one that is being repeated across the world. I mean, it may seem like it's India all of a sudden. There's a sort of very exotic thing of farmer suicides. And there are tens of thousands of farmer suicides in India a year. That's true. But actually, you see farmer suicides across the world. You see them, for example, in Australia recently, where farmers have borrowed very heavily to keep their lips above water just to be able to make it through the season. And there was a catastrophic drought in Australia, and farmers committed suicide there. And you farmers also, again, borrowing very heavily to stay, you know, just to stay in business in Britain. And all of a sudden, they were wiped out by foot and mouth disease. Their entire herd were destroyed by the government. And that's it. They faced the prospect of being the first people in their family's history, in generations. They faced the prospect of being the first family ever to lose that land. And rather than face that prospect, they despaired. So, I mean, and India is again an interesting place to look because, you know, I mean, obviously suicide isn't the only thing that's going on there. Some farmers have, in a political stunt, a very dark political stunt, invited their local politicians to come to their, you know, come to their village and the Amravati district in Maharashtra in India, and they've invited their politicians to come to a kidney sale centre where farmers would sell their organs to their politicians because they had nothing left to give. And this is happening in the same India that has now produced the largest number of people in the Forbes top 10 billionaires list. More than any other country is India in that top 10 list. And at the same time, India has the world's largest number of people with type 2 diabetes. And at the same time, India now has the world's largest concentration of people with hunger, and for the very poorest people in India, levels of hunger and food availability are shrinking. Food availability is shrinking, hunger's going up, to levels that haven't been seen since the British were there. Now, how is that possible? Well, I mean, it is possible because of the sort of liberalization of the market in India. In 1990, the man who is now Prime Minister of India, a guy called Manmohan Singh, liberalized the economy. And what that meant was that corporations were allowed in, and farm supports were shrunk, entitlement programs were kind of left to rot. The government has a sort of crop buying process that it is allowed to go basically to fall into dereliction. And so all of a sudden you have this open economic environment where trade is fully encouraged and people can accumulate wealth at exceptional rates. And there's marketing of food to kids and all of a sudden, you know, your kids want these sort of fizzy drinks that were unheard of or at least not pushed down their throats in the same way merely, you know, a few years before. Now, this process of liberalization isn't just happening in India. It's happening globally, and it happens through a particular vector. That vector is the World Bank. And it is important, I think, to have in your heads an image of what the World Bank does and how it operates. And it can seem a little technical sometimes with the World Bank's, and, you know, concessional loans and structural adjustment, conditionality, what have you. But there's an image that I find very useful, and it comes from the Terry Gilliam film, Time Bandits. Has anyone seen Time Bandits? Yeah, a couple. But those of you who have not seen Time Bandits, Time Bandits is about disgruntled former employees of God. The backstory is that the universe was built in 7 days, so it was a rush job. And there are holes, and the Time Bandits jump through these holes from, you know, robbing people. And the scene that I'm concerned that you appreciate is the one where they rob Napoleon and they end up in Sherwood Forest, where they are met by Robin Hood, played by John Cleese, as a kind of upper-class twit of the year. He sort of introduces himself as Hood. And he's very excited by Napoleon stuff. And he said, "Oh, but this is tremendous. The poor will love this." Have you met the poor? Of course, they don't have two pennies to rub together, but that's because they're poor. And there's this beautiful scene where Hood is handing out, he's a big pointy green hat, and he's sort of handing out the rubies and the gilded mirrors and the what have you, and the disheveled masses are sort of shaking his hand, "Oh, thanks very much." And he's walking down the line, and "There you go, jolly good. And here you are, rubies. And how long have you been poor? Jolly good." And sort of walks down the line. And right next to him is this big bloke who takes back whatever Hood has given and punches the poor person in the face. And that's how the World Bank works. Okay. That is kind of how the World Bank... Because there's certainly this sort of moment of, you know, have you met the poor? I mean, my moment of shame with the World Bank was I worked on a project called Voices of the Poor, Can Anyone Hear Us? It's toe-curlingly bad. I'm happy to talk about that in questions and you know, as some kind of atonement. This idea of the World Bank's like, well, some of our best friends are poor. You know, there is this sort of arrogation of expertise that they have about how they know what the poor are feeling. But there is also the idea that the World Bank gives things. It gives loans at rates of interest that are below market rates. So effectively, they're a kind of gift. But they're a gift that keeps on taking, because firstly, countries then have to pay back those loans, invariably having to pay them back in dollars, which means they have to reconfigure their economies so that they export stuff so they can earn dollars to repay the bank. But bank loans come with these conditions about liberalization and about needing to stop supporting your farmers and expose them to the free, the winds of free trade and the bracing winds of competition. But, of course, the level playing field is, as we know, not very level at all. Under World Trade Organization and World Bank rules, developing countries, the poorest farmers on earth, are not allowed to be supported by their governments. There will be no subsidies for them. There will be no grain marketing boards. There will be no tariffs to protect them. On the other hand, the United States and Europe are able to subsidize their agriculture to the tune of billions of dollars a year. And that is the level playing field. That's the sort of modern face of free market capitalism in food. It's a brutal system, and we need to think about what we can do. How are we going to change this? How are we going to take it on? How are we going to make it better? Now, the temptation might be to go down to the supermarket and to pick, go to the right aisle and find something that's organic and shade grown and fair trade and child-friendly, and locust-friendly, and whatever else it is that we think that will make us feel less guilty about being profiting in some way from this, and I think that's a very dangerous road to go because it falls into a distinctly American sort of desire, a distinctly American belief that we can together create a better world through shopping. And we can't. Before the fair trade people start fair trade beaming out of your eyes, bless you. I buy fair trade, right? I buy fair trade. I because what's the alternative? Hostile trade, unfair trade. Clearly it is important to support this, but it is also important not to be deluded that fair trade is going to change the world, because it won't. And of course, the moment we step into supermarkets, we are now in the new giants of the food system. Supermarkets are able to make other corporations bow down and worship. The largest food corporation, of course, is Walmart. The moment we step into a Walmart, we are at the other end of a system that exploits farmers and manipulates us. It's the same system. It's not like we're taught to believe that we profit from this. We don't profit. We suffer from it in very different ways from farmers, but and farm workers in particular. But nonetheless, we are manipulated by the same system. Because when you go into, Walmart, for example, has the world's second largest computer after the Pentagon. And they use it to monitor monitor sort of supply chains, get farmers to compete against each other, drive the price down, and also manipulate us in the way that we consume things, the way things are laid out in stores. The most simple example: why is the milk always at the back in supermarkets? Why is the milk always at the back? Because it is the single item that we are in supermarkets most often to buy. And so there's a golden triangle between the entrance and the milk and the checkout, where corporations bid and pay big cash to have their products facing you at eye level or at cart level if they're going for your kids. There is that sort of triangle where we are induced to consume more than we reasonably want to. And in fact, supermarkets are all about subverting our rational faculties. It's about impelling us towards certain kinds of consumption decisions. For example, why do supermarkets have bakeries in them now? It's not because supermarkets are making billions from buns. It's because the smell of baking bread makes us buy more stuff. And sometimes when supermarkets are too small to have the bakeries, they'll just add the smell into the air conditioning system. Everything about supermarkets, even the music, is manipulated. And there's big money, millions of dollars spent trying to figure out what music makes us buy more things. And, different experiments have been conducted. Is it going to be the samba? Is it going to be something cheerful? And the big money now is on depressing music. Apparently depressing music makes us buy more. As a result, millions of innocent people have been subjected to Annie Lennox. The moment we step into a supermarket, we subject ourselves to this. And I think it would be preposterous to expect Walmart To be, you know, to be the solution to this kind of global capitalism. To expect Walmart to be waving the red flag of workers' rights. You know, we stand for fair trade at Walmart. We're great. And at the same time, of course, they exploit their workers. Some workers at Walmart have been denied rest breaks to the extent that actually they've had to urinate at the till, rather than, you know, they've not been able to get out. And Walmart Germany had an interesting experience. The employees in Walmart Germany hid in the toilet rather than do the daily Walmart cheer. You know, give me a W, give me an A, give me an L, give me a squiggly, give me an M. Squiggly, by the way, is what the Walmart Corporation says separates the wall from them. It's wall squiggly mart, but the squiggly is silent. Walmart wanted the Germans to say squiggly, and they wouldn't. And in fact, now that there is no Walmart Germany, and because of worker organizing there, they've managed to get Walmart out of their country, which is fantastic. And yet we go to supermarkets because they're convenient. And this is one of the last stories I want to tell you. This idea of convenience is something that we need to understand and be very suspicious about. And the story I want to give you is a story from South Africa, from apartheid South Africa. When apartheid, that vicious and brutal period in human history where whites and blacks were forcibly separated by violence, it required laws. It was a sort of juridical process of making sure that these laws were in place. Now, one of those laws was the Regulation of Separate Amenities Act of 1947. The consequences were that white people and black people could no longer use the same bathroom, could no longer use the same washing facilities, no longer use the same plates or cutlery or eating facilities. And this was a problem, and particularly a problem for black caddies on a white golf course in Durban, South Africa's third city. And they came up with a food that became one of Durban's signature foods. It's called bunny chow. Bunny chow's fabulous. It's a loaf of white bread with the inside scooped out, and it's filled with curry. So it's brilliant because you run out from your golf course, you go to the bunny chow guy, you get your bunny chow, he fills it up, and then you have a limited amount of time to finish eating it. Because the curry's seeping into the bread and it'll get all soggy. So you take a bit, you dip it in, you eat, and you take in dip and you eat, and you do it until it's done. So you have to eat it quickly. But once it's finished, there's nothing left. There's no way you don't have to worry about separate dining facilities or anything because you've been eating it on the hoof. Now, I like it because, first, of course, it is a compliance with the law. But secondly, it's a mixed food. It is, white bread, the food of white people, and curry, the food of black people, and it's mixed. It's a kind of gastronomic subversion. It's a kind of culinary way of saying, fuck you, which I find tremendously important. But at the same time, I think the important lesson here is that it is an example of the world's first government-sponsored fast food. There's nothing convenient about putting curry in a loaf of white bread. It's a preposterous idea. And yet, because of the circumstances of society, because of the laws that were put in place, because of the needs, the rhythms of work and of food, all of a sudden, eating this stuff becomes convenient. It becomes necessary. And I think that's the clue to unlocking why our food looks so weird today. And why we are forced into very strange behaviors in this country. Outside the United States, I use this figure to shock people. The figure is that 20% of American fast food meals are eaten in cars. And people outside the United States are appalled. And they wonder, is it because Americans love their cars? Is this why? Is this a fondness for the dashboard that people would like to? I'm sure there's a little bit of that. But I think that the main reason is that we understand that Americans are working so much harder than anyone else in the industrialized world for things that everyone else in the industrialized world kind of takes for granted. You know, things like healthcare. Things like the possibility of a pension, things like an education system that you can afford without going bankrupt, things like affordable housing. All of this stuff is denied Americans, which is why Americans are working harder and for less now than they were under Reagan. Working American salaries have gone down. So if that's the case, of course, and you're working two jobs to be able to keep, keep your head above water. And if you're a working American, then chances are working class neighborhoods are much further away from the places that people work. So you spend a long time commuting. And communities of working people have less access to fresh fruits and vegetables. There's something called supermarket redlining, where the only thing that's worse than having a supermarket is not having one. There is no fresh fruits and vegetables. Very hard to find fresh fruits and vegetables. Very hard to find green public space in communities of poor people. Well, then, is it any wonder that the one hot meal that you can have during the day you are forced to eat off your lap, and that is convenient? But, of course, at the end of the day, this is the choice between Burger King and McDonald's, and that's no choice at all. And this is the hardest thing, I think, for people to understand. When we have our food, we believe that our food is made for us. But the truth is, in every way that matters, we are being made for our food. We are being transformed into the sorts of people living the sorts of rhythms and lives where all of a sudden the most preposterous things become convenient. A McDonald's meal becomes convenient. I was at a gas station recently where something called Snickers Charged becomes convenient. Have you heard of Snickers Charged? It's like Red Bull. Red Bull, a sort of urine-coloured drink that is rich in sugar and caffeine and a couple of other things that are found in urine, weirdly, taurine and creatine. Anyway, so Snickers Charged is a Snickers bar. It's like this puppy here, but with added caffeine and vitamins and taurine as well. I mean, it's like Coke, the Diet Coke Plus. You've heard of Diet Coke Plus, the Diet Coke with added vitamins. What is up with our lives that we have to that all of a sudden we find ourselves reaching for that as the kind of the kind of food that is convenient? So if we're going to tackle this, we need to get involved in social change, not shopping. And the group that I find very inspirational in this, and as I'm sure many of you do too, is the Italian Communist Party. The Italian Communist Party are brilliant. They asked a very important question in the early 1970s. They asked, why is it that only rich people get to enjoy food? Why is it that only rich people get pleasure from their food? And enjoy the sensuousness of food and have time to connect with food and understand and appreciate where food comes from and really savor it. And the organization that they set up was an organization called Slow Food. Now, in the United... I mean, there are sometimes one or two Slow Food people in the audience, and so now's a good time for earmuffs, please. Because in its worst moments... I know there are some very good people in Slow Food in the United States, but in its worst moments, it is a very bourgeois organization. And it is, in other words, a sort of circle jerk of olive oil fancies. My goodness, yeah, that's the sentence. Thank you, sir. Okay, earmuffs off, everyone. it can be a... My goodness. Slow Food can be the sort of bunch of tossers who like olive oil. And it doesn't have to be. It doesn't have to... And in Italy, it isn't. In Italy, they ask a very radical question. They come up with a radical answer. What are the two things that you need in order to be able to enjoy food? What are the two things that working Americans need in order to be able to savor food? Time and money. So they get involved in union campaigns, driving up the wages for agricultural workers through union and through organizing, to be able to create cash to be able to enjoy food. And particularly now, when the price of food is going through the roof, I'm happy to answer questions about that. When the price of food is going through the roof, of course people need more money. But the other thing that people need is time. And so they organized a two-hour lunch break in the working day so that people could take the time to get, to do the things we always do in lunch break, run around, go to the bank, post some letters, but also sit down and connect with your food. And that, for me, is a sort of an example of the kinds of things that we can and should be doing. Not shopping, but getting involved in politics, in organizing, in reclaiming, things like a living wage. If you care about food, you have to care about a living wage. Otherwise, it just becomes a sort of middle-class fascination with the latest kind, latest variety of olive. or you know the new the, you know this year's Cabernet, and that's that to me I think is bollocks. I mean, we do need something that's far more radical, far more engaged, far more egalitarian, and that is the promise of a group called Via Campesina, and this is my last point. All the ideas that I've been suggesting and sharing with you and all the analysis that I've been sharing with you comes from Via Campesina. Via Campesina is an international peasant movement, a movement of peasants and landless workers, which by some estimates has 150 million members. And they, you know, they have representatives in the United States, the National Family Farm Coalition. There's a migrant coalition that's interested in migrant labor in the United States. They're part of Via Campesina. And in fact, Via Campesina has something to say to Seattle, because the World Trade Organization burst into our consciousness and is here. We became aware of the World Trade Organization here in 1999. And yet, 7 years before that, the charter document for the World Trade Organization had been translated into an Indian language, into Kannada. And it was being discussed in the fields of Karnataka in India by a movement of 20 million farmers. They were way ahead of the game. And they've all, you know, the farmers have always been at sort of the wedge end of policies of colonialism, imperialism, brutality, modern capitalism. They've got some good ideas about how to fight back. And the major idea is one called food sovereignty. It's a long definition, and Wikipedia has a nice summary of it. I urge you to go to Wikipedia and look at food sovereignty. But basically the idea is we need a democratic conversation about food. And this is the point I want to leave you on, I think, that that actually having a democratic conversation about food is the one thing that most of us, and particularly people in developing countries, have never had. And in this country, we've had it, you know, the poor cousin to democracy. What we experience as democracy is, in fact, consumer choice. Travis was giving me showed me something today that where Mountain Dew has three different new possible Mountain Dews that are going to come out. One of them's Shockwave, one of them's Voltage, one of them's Revolution, and you get to choose which of these gets to be your new Mountain Dew. If this has any if it has echoes of the current presidential thing, do let me know. But this is called Dumocracy, where you get to choose between three almost indistinguishable sort of sugary drinks, and that's how we experience democracy. It's Coke or Pepsi in the supermarket and Coke or Pepsi in the ballot box, and I think that. The what we need to become more attuned to and more engaged with is a deeper concept of democracy. Via Campesina has been doing it in a number of places, and that's why this book is subtitled The Hidden Battle, because there are people fighting back across the world. At the end of the day, we have to realize that we are not consumers of democracy. We are its proprietors, and we need to act accordingly. I think we'll leave it there, but I'll be very happy to take your questions. Thank you. Biofuels, just in case, particularly in the United States, the idea is that you would take yellow corn and you would turn it into ethanol. And you would use that to put in your car and use it as flex fuel, and this is the way of the future. Now, the European Union was also big on biofuels. It was very exciting to be able to have a policy where the fuel was renewable. Excuse me, and that offered a great deal. It seemed to be a way of having an unlimited supply of fuel. It's renewable. It comes from the ground again and again. It's not like oil. But the trouble is, renewable isn't sustainable. Renewable, yes, comes out of the ground. Sustainable, no. It takes more energy to make ethanol out of corn than you get by burning it, and it produces more CO2. Than you get by than you save by not burning an equivalent amount of fossil fuel, this is why the European Union is sort of backing away. But again, I mean, we're in an election year, and George Bush said it quite well over the weekend or last weekend that he was an ethanol guy, to paraphrase him, that it's better to burn American corn than it is to burn Saudi oil. And so it's a sort of jingoistic idea that substitutes for an energy policy. But it's interesting because, I mean, it's to me the sort of elephant in the room here is around the what passes for an energy policy in the United States or any country. Come to think of that, too often we think we've got an energy policy when we've got our hands on something to which we can set fire. You know, if it's control of oil, then that's one thing. If it's control of ethanol, on another. But energy policy is weirdly pyromaniac. You know, I mean, it's about having something you can burn. And I think what's important to think about in terms of energy policy is moving away from our dependence on things, you know, things that work inside internal combustion engines. We need to de-link from that kind of demand for energy. I mean, I think an energy policy is a policy where we end up using less. And certainly substituting with solar and with wind power. And I mean, there's some promising things involving cyanobacteria where you can create kinds of hydrocarbons offshore in salty water by growing the right kind of bacteria. I mean, it all sounds a little Frankensteinish, but people who know this sort of thing have, you know, have favorable things to say about it. I mean, I'll look at the evidence and see, as we all must. But certainly in the short term, the answer can't be to take land that could be used for food and instead of eating that food, setting it on fire. I think that that's a very bad idea, particularly when there are so many hungry people in the world. And I think, you know, moving away from a kind of energy policy that is dependent on fossil fuel means doing a lot of things, actually. It means reconfiguring the way our cities are built, because they're built for cars. They're not built for people. They're not built for public transport. We do need to be thinking very seriously about how to be moving towards a way of living that isn't about a dependency on fossil fuel or the internal combustion engine, but imagining an energy policy much, much bigger and much, much more different. There are five reasons why the price of food has gone up. One is the price of oil. Because when the price of oil goes up, the price of shipping goes up, obviously, but also the price of fertilizer goes up, because fertilizers are made with fossil fuels, mainly natural gas. So price of oil goes up, price of fertilizer goes up, price of fuel goes up. The second reason is biofuels. I mean, biofuels have a series of effects. One, they drive up the price of corn. They reduce the amount of corn that's available for yellow corn, for example, that's available for eating. And therefore, it sends a market signal for farmers to switch from growing things like wheat to growing corn. So it already has distortion effects in other markets and in other commodities. But also, of course, it drives up the price of substitutes. So the price of yellow corn has gone up, so the price of white corn goes up. And people speculate and bid it up. And all of a sudden, the price of white corn becomes beyond the reach of the people who depend on it. And that is why, as a result of biofuels policy, we saw tortilla riots in Mexico last year, because the price of yellow corn, white corn went up so high that it became impossible to afford the staple food in Mexico. And that was directly to do with the biofuels policy. On top of that, there's been crappy harvests. A range of weird weather events have been happening around the world. People are saying this is climate change. Climatologists run screaming from the room because you can't say that this weather event was climate change as opposed to merely random. But you can certainly say that overall we're seeing some dodgy stuff happening. I mean, the typhoon in Burma being the most recent example. But you know, there are a range of reasons why harvests have failed, most of them climatic and odd. The fourth reason is increased demand in meat. The president this weekend was blaming the Indian middle class for the rise in the price of food, because he says when them 350 million Indian middle class folks get rich, they start demanding things, and that this is the reason why the price of food has gone up. To me, that's sort of thinly veiled racism, frankly. And you can see it. You can also see it in the New York Times reporting about Chinese demand for pork. All of a sudden, those damn Asians are, they're wanting their pork and their cheese, and they're sending us all to hell in a handbasket. Damn them. It is, of course, profoundly racist. It is also a way of, again, avoiding the tough conversation, not about growing middle-class demand or population in Asia, which is also conjured up by this, but about the size of the footprint of the U.S. consumption. Because there isn't enough planet to be able to have the kinds of consumption of meat and of energy and of everything else that we have here shared among the rest of the world. There just isn't enough planet to do that. But that's a question that never gets asked. Instead, it's, you know, those Indians. I mean, exaggerating the size of the Indian middle class, there aren't 350 million Indian middle class people. The number's substantially smaller. But again, you know, there is that sort of idea. And then on top of this, there's financial speculation. And financial speculation, I mean, we're all familiar with the housing bubble, right? Where the housing, you know, the price of houses went up, not because all of a sudden there weren't any houses around, and, you know, we were competing for the last few houses. The price of houses went up because everyone believed the price of houses would go up. And you know, this is the sort of textbook definition of a bubble, where there is no other factor driving the price up other than the reasonable expectation that the price will be higher. now, actually, this is how famines happen. In every major famine since the Second World War, there's always been food around. But the reason people starve is not because of insufficiency of food, but because the price is being driven up in speculation. So in Bengal, for example, in 1943, one of the biggest famines, one of the most important famines as well, there was plenty of rice around. But the reason people starved is because those who could afford it hoarded the rice in the reasonable expectation that the price of rice would go up. The price of rice did go up. They made tons of cash. But in the meantime, between 1.5 and 4 million people died because they couldn't afford the rice at the price that was being set by the speculation. So that's certainly going on. And of course, you know, speculation sits at one end of a continuum. At the other end is straightforward collusion. We were talking about Archer Daniels Midland. In fact, I forgot to address that point. I mean, Archer Daniels Midland the biofuels policy is just one of the things that Archer Daniels Midland has encouraged the US government to do. And I talk about this in the book, about how Archer Daniels Midland first encouraged the US government to support corn prices because it was in the strategic national interest to be able to have a ton of corn. And then Archer Daniels Midland encouraged the US government to fund its plants that transformed corn into high fructose corn syrup because it was strategically important to be able to do something with this corn. And it sort of lay in the US national interest. Certainly Archer Daniels Midland and a few oil companies as well are pushing for biofuels because, again, this is another chance for them to drive up the price of something and make a ton of cash. So the price of food is going up. I mean, the thing is, and there are lots of reasons for that, but we do produce more food than ever before. And I think the reason the price of food is going up, and it is in short supply for people who can't afford it, is because we distribute it through the market, and we've gotten rid of all those things that would have provided a safety net for people. The food stamp program has been cut back, and all the rest of it.
Yeah, but also the fact that globalization has forced a lot of countries that used to grow food into exporting commodities for the dollar, and that they can't produce food anymore, so they're dependent on the Cargill and Archer Daniels Midland.
Absolutely. I mean, now 70% of developing countries are net food importing developing countries, and that's one of the reasons why it's hurting so hard. If you look at a country that has gone through this, the country that comes to mind is Cuba, because they went through a period. Cuba was this hugely industrialized, very sort of heavily dependent on industrial agriculture through the Soviet Union. Its role in the Warsaw Pact was it provided the sugar and the rum and what have you to Eastern Europe, and Eastern Europe sent the tractors and the fertilizers and the oil. And that carried on very happily until the Soviet Union collapsed and Cuba found itself high and dry. It found itself in a world where it couldn't begin to afford the oil price, and it found itself in a world where it didn't have the foreign exchange to afford the high price of food. In other words, we're in a situation that's very similar to the one we're seeing a lot of developing countries facing today. So the Cuban response, well, firstly, there were two very dark years called the special period. It's a euphemism for that. But what then happened was that the Cuban people demanded a couple of things. First, they demanded land reform. Land reform is amazing technology to be able to increase productivity on land. We don't think of it as a technology because we like to think that fertilizers are a technology. Land reform is no less a technology for increasing productivity on land. So they demanded land reform so that they could pass land on to their kids. The second thing that they demanded was sustainable agricultural technology. Not industrial, not agrochemicals, because in any case they couldn't afford them, but the kinds of complex soil, soil-improving intercropping systems and biodynamic systems that increase soil fertility and allow allow the soil to recover and become part of a great ecosystem. So, you know, you grow a nitrogen-fixing plant next to something you use for fiber, next to something you use for fuel, next to something you eat, next to something that attracts the right kind of beneficial pests, you know, the whole thing. And it becomes a sort of rich, really sophisticated, very scientifically intensive kind of ecosystem. And, you know, it is important, by the way, to make this case that when you oppose industrial agriculture or genetically modified agriculture, one often gets called a Luddite. But of course, even the Luddites weren't Luddites. To stand in the way of this particular model of agriculture is still to demand science, and that's what farmers in developing countries want. I was involved in a sort of straw poll around this, and the number one thing that farmers in developing countries want is not fair trade. That's way down. Number one thing is land reform. Number two is access to water, and number three is access to sustainable technology. So, I mean, in terms of what needs to happen in developing countries, I think, we definitely... I'll get to here, because in developing countries, certainly shifting away from industrial agriculture and export agriculture towards this rich, biodynamic, sort of agroecological solution, definitely the way to go. And that's a conclusion that was recently vindicated by a group called the IAASTD, the International Agricultural Assessment on Science, Knowledge, and Technology for Development. So we wonks got very excited about that. But basically what they were saying is that to be able to feed the 9 billion people who will be on this planet by 2050, we need to have agroecological local solutions. Developing countries face the kinds of trouble that Cuba did, you know, high oil prices and high food import prices. The U.S. doesn't face that. The kinds of constraints that are faced in the United States are ones that are imposed by income, particularly for working Americans. I mean, working Americans here are now doing things that, if it were happening for any other reason, we might be very happy. People are eating less. They're eating less food, and they're eating less meat, and they're growing their own fresh fruits and vegetables. But of course, this isn't happening because people choose to do that, but because food is now beyond the reach of so many working American families. You know, the lines outside food banks are so long because of working American families have been driven into the ground. Now, that's a very different series of pressures because, you know, still this country supports industrial agriculture. It's about to pass a multi-billion dollar farm bill. The way that agriculture works in this country is very different from developing countries. And so the way to make that change is not to rely on the external constraints of, you know, high oil price and, high food imports, but actually it's going to take a lot more politics here and a lot more political engagement and a lot more demands from the government than in other countries because, you know, the government has in many ways so comprehensively been bought by business interests in this country. So it's a bigger struggle here.